my name's Ali, and this is the Russophiles Unite podcast, where we watch Russian films and films with a Russian connection. As always, I'm joined by a guest, and today my guest is Ed, but not as always. Ed is joining us from Moscow, so that's pretty cool. Hi, Ed. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Ali. Thanks very much for asking me on. I'm a teacher here in Moscow, and I'm now a senior teacher, a senior assistant director of studies at a language school, a private language school here in Moscow. And I used to work with Ali.
Yes, yes. In fact, for a little while, you were actually my boss. So that's...
Yes, and don't you forget it, Ali. Don't you forget it. Yes,
I've not forgotten. Still, nearly 5 years later. You were already in Moscow when I got there back in 2009. But remind me, how long have you been there now?
Well, I've been here sort of permanently since beginning of 2006. So that is about 12 and a half years, actually. But it's not, that wasn't the first time I ever came. But yeah, 12 and a half years, yes, working here. As a teacher. And before that, I was here in 2001 the first time doing a research project back when I was working as a chemist. That was at the university. And I met my partner then, and we've been together ever since. And I moved here permanently in 2006.
Ah, so it was the... meeting your partner was the catalyst for you coming there.
Absolutely, yes, yes.
I'm probably misusing the word catalyst terribly there, but
that's
what happens when you have
a
humanities person talking to a scientist. So.
Well, yes, my chemistry is extremely rusty, I'm afraid, but yes, I think catalyst is the right word.
Okay.
I did the training course here, and then when I was just finishing my PhD, I came over here for good. Well, for the foreseeable future, yes.
Yeah, yes. And at 12 years and counting, that's quite a stretch. So, I know these things are sometimes quite difficult to measure, but in that time, how has Moscow changed as a place, or is the change even particularly perceptible? Because, you know, when you're there all the time, it's so incremental, sometimes it can be hard to notice.
Well, some obvious changes have happened. The really very obvious change is the amount of traffic. I mean, the first time I was here, Of course, lots of people drove, but not everybody drove, and so the traffic really wasn't so unbelievably bad as it can be now. There's a lot of more sort of Western style shops around. When I was first in Moscow, I heard people tell me that they went to a market full of traders from India to buy a refrigerator, and they would take a little trolley on the metro and bring their refrigerator home. Whereas now, of course, there are just electrical showrooms for all those things. When I was first here, there were lots and lots of markets. There were a few supermarkets, but mostly, you know, street markets and places like that where people would buy food. But now they've all been taken away, so that's not there. Lots of casinos before as well, which struck me, but they've now been outlawed in Moscow. So you can't see any casinos anywhere anymore. Whenever I've never been to Las Vegas, but whenever I've seen Las Vegas on TV, I think that looks exactly like the Novy Arbat. This huge road used to look, doesn't look like that anymore because all the casinos are gone and all of the gaudy lights are gone now. It looks just a lot less vulgar than it used to, I suppose.
Mm. Although at least when I was there, it did have an awful lot of tourist and kind of quite kitschy souvenir shops, and you know, where you could get really ridiculously overpriced matryoshki, like Russian dolls, so, and things like that.
Yeah, I think there's still quite a lot of that. Some of those markets where they used to sell them are still open, but you know, even on Tverskaya Street, which is that huge, well, shopping street in the middle of Moscow, there's a supermarket, but in the windows, it's advertising all the overpriced souvenirs and all that thing. I mean, it's still there. Hmm. I don't go to the old Arbat very much, but that's where all the tourists go, and that's still full of all the stuff it was full of before, you know.
Yes.
Kiosks and all those things, yeah.
Sorry, I think I was conflating Novi and Stari, new and old Arbat. Mm-hmm. And yes, old Arbat is the more pedestrianised, yeah, one with the touristy bits. And then the new one, which is roughly parallel, is much more of a, like a regular big, well, not motorway, but, you know, big multiple lane
absolutely
road.
Yeah, but it always used to remind me of Las Vegas, as I say. It really did. Used to have all the flashing lights and the casinos and all those things, and that's all kind of gone now. Just in the past couple of years, actually, they've been modernizing certain bits and pieces, I think in aid of the football tournament. Lots of the metro has been anglicised now, so there's plenty of signs in English now in the metro and on the street that weren't there even just 3 years ago. It's quite funny that all of the announcements now of the station names are now bilingual, Russian and then English, with this very, very strange English pronunciation of all of the Russian names. Very odd. Not really very helpful to people trying to decode them, I think, who can't speak Russian, because they're so eccentric, the pronunciations, but yes.
Yeah, that's a big change, because they didn't have that at all. I mean, if you looked very hard at the maps that they would stick on the side of the inside of the metro carriages, you could see in fainter writing underneath the Cyrillic names of the stations, you could see the anglicised versions. But that didn't particularly help you, because once you actually got into the stop, if you looked out of the window, all you could see was the Cyrillic version. So if you couldn't read that, you were a bit stuffed. I mean, that was the one major bit of advice I would give to anyone going to Moscow, was at least familiarize yourself with roughly how to read the Cyrillic alphabet, which isn't as hard as people assume that learning an alphabet's going to be. But yes, it is a considerable obstacle. So it's interesting to know that that's changed. The other thing I hear is that all of the, you know, not entirely legally there, little stalls and stands in the Perikhodi, the underpasses, have now been ripped out, which, that is very weird to me, as they were such a feature of what the place was like.
Yeah, that's true. When I was first in Moscow, and up until just a few years ago, yes, probably up until more or less the time when you left, they did have a lot of these stalls everywhere, but they ripped lots of them out because they were of a dubious legal standing, and they are actually putting some new ones in, some new slightly posher ones into some of these underpasses and places like that. They are putting some new ones in, but very, very slowly, and I fear a lot of people will have lost their livelihoods because of it, because of this move.
Yeah, basically because people didn't have planning permission but were just kind of allowed to get on with it for many years, it was sort of tacitly okay. Maybe there should have been some kind of process for legalizing things, but
yes, very doesn't interest the people making the decisions, I fear. Yes,
no, I suspect not kind of thing. But yes, we're straying into very political waters now, so
yes, be careful, we don't know who might be listening. Yes,
indeed the joke that I would constantly make when I was living there. Yeah, so on a more positive note, what are your favorite things about living, I would say, in Russia, but in Moscow specifically?
Well, I grew up in the countryside. Now, of course, that brings lots of benefits, but one big disadvantage is it's very isolating, especially when you can't drive, and I still can't drive, even at my great age. The transport is really great, and I know that's a rather boring way of describing it, but the metro really is a very, very convenient, well-priced, and very interesting way to travel around, I find. So that's one thing. Not such an exciting thing, perhaps, but it is one thing. Some really nice parks around the city, which I like. I like to go around. What else? Lots of cultural things. I don't go to the theatre as often as I'd like to, but when I have, it's invariably been a very interesting experience. I tend to go to the sort of musical things like operas and ballets, and they tend to be very, very interesting. Some of the ones which are the old productions that haven't really changed very much since they started. We saw a production of Swan Lake, which was basically the same the same production as the original. And then you see some new stuff. We saw a relatively new production of Carmen, the opera. That was really very interesting. In summer, I find it really a very nice place. Even when it's very hot, you get these long, long days. You can get so much done and you know, full of energy. It's the winter that can do for you a little bit. But yes, so those are some of the things I think that I enjoy here.
Yeah, that's definitely a lot of overlap with things that I liked about my time there. And of course, as far as the not getting out to see plays and things, it is sort of the bane of one's existence as an English teacher teaching classes in the evenings. That's when the plays are on, so
of course
you
yes,
don't get to see
yes.
those. The place I lived for the first 2 years in Moscow, down in Yugozapadnaya, the southwest of the city, I walked past a local theatre on my way home every day, so I'd always see, like, oh, they have this going on. You know, it would be Chekhov and adaptations of Shakespeare, and I was kind of like, my Russian isn't really good enough to enjoy those yet, but it'd be nice to go, except I'm working, so I won't be. Never mind.
Yes, of course, yes. Well, there is that, but such is life, yes.
Indeed. But moving from the stage to the screen, the film we're watching today is... Belle Sansa Pustini, the White Sun of the Desert, which is kind of a classic Soviet film from 1969, directed by Vladimir Motyl. This is one you've not seen yet, is that right?
That's right. I've only very vaguely heard about it. When we were discussing which film we might like to see, I do find Soviet films interesting. I haven't really watched as many as I probably should have done, but I do find just something that's made in a different time, in almost a different society, just a very interesting thing to experience, especially if it tells you something about the time it was made in. I haven't heard very much about it, but it seems to be pitched as a sort of a Western, but a Soviet Western, not set in the Wild West, but set in the desert area of the Soviet Union. And I understand that people call those Easterns, but I haven't really heard much about it, so I'm very much looking forward to finding out about it.
Yes, yeah, I've seen a couple of different terms thrown around, like some people call it a Red Western. I've seen it called like an Eastern, as you say, or an Ostern, as in Ost, as in the German word for East. So yeah, it's kind of supposed to be having similar elements to Western, but usually transposed, as you say, to a Soviet setting. And this one, as I understand, is set during the civil war between the Reds and the Whites in the late 19-teens, early 1920s. So, and apparently that's quite a typical setting for this genre of film. I must say, because it's set in Central Asia and it was made, you know, nearly 50 years ago, I'm a bit concerned about how it might handle sort of inter-ethnic and intercultural stuff. Like, it could be a bit racist or patronizing, or
I've seen the film Kavkazskaya Plyennitsa, which is this comedy film which is set in the Caucasus, and
yes, the Prisoner of the Caucasus.
Yes, it's Prisoner of the Caucasus, that's the serious film. This is the comedy. Yes. So it's often translated as a Kidnapping Caucasian Style,
yes,
loses some of the joke, I think, of it being the female prisoner of the Caucasus, whereas the original story was the male prisoner of the Caucasus. But anyway, and that kind of avoided the racism that it might be accused of by making it so general that anybody who might take offence thought it was making fun of other people.
I
understand. Right. Because it never said that this person was from, let's say, I don't know, Armenia or Georgia or something. So anybody from Armenia would assume it was making fun of everyone else, and everyone from Georgia would assume it was making fun of everyone else as well. It was kind of so generalised. Well, we shall see. There was some very odd things that I'm sure you wouldn't see in a modern Western film, but I'm sure you would see in something like a Carry On film of that similar vintage.
Oh, goodness,
you know,
yes.
It actually reminds me a bit of Carry On Spying or Carry On Up the Khyber. That's this other film.
Yes.
Now, I'm very interested to see what tone this film adopts. I really haven't seen. Well, I haven't seen any westerns, I think, if I'm very honest. So if it's copying, I don't know if it will be copying the sort of old American westerns or possibly the Italian style westerns, I don't know, which I believe have a rather different tone. Or from what little I've read, it sounds like it might have a slightly ironic tone to it, I don't know.
Yes, yeah, I think I've heard it has sort of a jokey tone. And I've also heard that quite a lot of phrases from the film have just kind of passed into the everyday Russian lexicon. Like, there are just these cliches and things that people say that originally came from here and that people will just say them at opportune moments. But I guess it'll be interesting once we've watched it to see whether there's any lines where you go, oh yeah, people say that a lot and now I know it's from this. So
yeah that, I'd look out for it, certainly. Yes,
all right, so we should probably get on and watch the film. But before we do that, we'll say what we always say on this show, which is a word of Russian that Yuri Gagarin said as he was blasting off to become the first man in space. Now, there's actually a cosmonaut-related fact about this film that you were telling me just before we came on air, as it were, Ed.
Yes, it turns out that there was a disaster where three cosmonauts died. I've got to get the numbers wrong, but I think it was Soyuz number 11 where that happened. I may have got it wrong. But after that, they started, for good luck, watching this film. That's cosmonauts when they go up in their Soyuz rockets. They watch this film every time before they take off. And every time since that disaster, they treat it as a kind of a talisman, shall we say, because no Russian cosmonauts, touch wood, have perished since that single disaster back then. So they always watch it every time before they take off.
Wow, so let's hope it's a good film then, because if you feel like you have to watch it every time before you blast off, you hope that it's something decent. I mean, maybe it's just such a good film that they want to, you know, a pretext to keep watching it. I don't know.
Well, let's hope so. Yes, let's
okay.
hope so.
So that word of Russian then is
Poyekhali.
And welcome back. We've just watched The White Son of the Desert. And before we discuss what we thought of the film, Ed is going to give us a quick summary of the plot. This is the point where we say, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the film and don't want to know how it ends, look away or listen away now. Okay, so that alert out the way. Over to you, Ed.
Right, so yeah, it was a very interesting film, I have to say. So let's think. It concerns this member of the Red Army called Sukhov, and he's totally unflappable. And this is his character. Nothing can ruffle him. He's always totally in control. He's the hero. He's our hero for this. And in fact, before we even start, it starts with a daydream, and he does this quite a lot throughout the film, this daydream where he's imagining back somewhere in the western part of Russia, we're not quite sure where.
Yeah, I think he briefly mentions somewhere near Samara, but I may have totally got that wrong.
So, a very, you know, wooded area with fields and that kind of thing, you know, really nice countryside. He's imagining it. There's his wife, and he is imagining his wife quite a lot of the time. He's writing to his wife in this very high-blown and flowery style. And anyway, he's imagining that, but then suddenly we cut away from this image of his wife back to the Central Asian desert, where of course this tale takes place. He's been invalided out of the as I understand, he was invalided out of the army in Asia, and on the banks of the Caspian, as I understand it, and now he's walking home by himself. I find this situation rather unlikely, but I don't know. It's not the first time I've seen this in a Soviet film where somebody's basically walking home
across a desert.
Yeah, I think, what did I see? Wedding in Malinovka, which was a musical, and there's some guys just walk up, just having come back from the Civil War, as far as I'm aware. It's the same sort of time.
Yes, it's important to mention the setting. So this is...
It's early 20s, I suppose.
Yeah, it's either at the very tail end of the war between the Whites and the Reds, or it's just finished, it's just wrapped up.
I think it's... Whether the hot part of the war is still going on, I don't know. But obviously there are pockets of resistance still, and that's kind of what part of what this is about. But so he's tramping through the desert, and what does he find? He finds the guy buried, doesn't he, first?
He finds a head.
Yes, he finds a head, and the head belongs to this...
local.
This Central Asian guy. He's a Turkman, I suppose. And his name's Said, and he's been buried there as sort of punishment for... not punishment, but by his enemy, Javdet, I think was his name, wasn't it? The enemy, and our hero sort of rescues him, and then they come across a sort of skirmish, don't they, with the Red Army skirmishing with some Basmachi rebels. Is that how we could describe them? Basmachi brigands.
Yeah, rebels / bandits. Yeah, brigands is a good word. Yeah, yeah.
Now, I had to look up what the Basmachi were. My knowledge of the Civil War is pretty thin. But as far as I understand, that they were people who objected very much to the Russian Empire being there in the first place, because the Russian Empire had tried to modernize their agriculture, which meant a load of the peasants had lost all their land, and they were now either working or, even worse, not working on huge Russian farms. And they definitely thought that the Soviet Union was a kind of continuation of the Russian Empire, really. So it wasn't representing them, the proletariat, the local proletariat. It was just representing the Russians who were still in charge and should be rebelled against. And these people were landless and possibly jobless and all of those things, so they had given themselves a reason to be against these people. They're portrayed in the film as bandits, of course, and so they're having this skirmish, and then they're told, then Sukhov is told that he has to look after all of the wives of this particular bandit lord, I suppose, called Abdullah, and so he starts looking after these women, and they are wearing burqas most of the time. You can't see their faces. They are still very much part of this old style society where the husband is in charge of a group of wives, and they have to do everything he says.
Yeah, intensely patriarchal, and they make a big deal about the burqa thing and not being able to see. To show their faces to a man who isn't their husband / owner.
And to be honest, this was one of the funniest things I thought in the film, that they're in this museum. I think the museum is in this city called Merv, which is a famous sort of ancient city, but it's a museum, and they've labelled the museum with a sign that says something like a female dormitory or something like that, which doesn't sound very funny in English, but you know, these obshchitia, these dormitories, were what they labelled things that had been private property but were now being occupied with lots of people, workers basically. So this was the female obshchitia, and they're living there. So he starts looking after these women. I mean, he's not taking advantage of them in any way. He's looking after them, and he's also been left. He's been basically commanded to do this by the people who he just met, and he's also been left this very young soldier. Pavlik, is that his name?
Petrucha, I thought.
Ah, Petrucha, yes, you're quite right. Yes, 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 Petrucha.
Who's probably like 16, 17, if that. He's very baby-faced.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a very, very young guy, and he's doing his best as well to some extent, although he falls in love with one of the wives, but it's actually, you know, a very innocent and straightforward, it's portrayed as. The wives, I found the wives are silent, basically, with the exception of one, Gülçatay, who does get to talk a bit. We also meet, who else do we meet? We meet the customs official, don't we? Who's the only Russian guy in this town in modern-day Turkmenistan, I think that's right.
Yeah, I think there's one other older man who sort of looks after, like, a local, what's been turned into a museum or something, and he's a much older man. But apart from him, that's right.
Was he Russian? I'm not sure. Was he not? I'm not sure anyway. But yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I thought he was probably Russian, but I could be wrong.
But he's there with his wife, and there's this really quite touching relationship, I think, between him and his wife. Their son has died, and they have this quite prickly relationship, but it becomes very clear that the reason that they're always at each other's throats is because their son's gone. And the wife is complaining, oh, you've spoilt the best years of my life and all of these things. But it's clear that they absolutely love each other. But the pain of this son having disappeared is still very raw. I don't know how it happened. I don't think it's really painted in. I don't know if it was during the war or the revolution or what. But that's really quite poignant, I find. Even though the character he's an alcoholic. There's a scene. Because he's a customs official, I mean, he's obviously being paid all sorts of bribes, I imagine. And there's one scene where he's complaining, "Oh no, not caviar again! Must I eat caviar?" And his wife's force feeding him caviar, this kind of thing, black caviar. Yes,
yeah. He says, "I just want some bread."
Yes, absolutely.
Which apparently is hard to come by. But yeah, I also read into it that he's kind of lost his. As well as his son, he's kind of lost his purpose as he was a Tsarist official. And I don't know whether he's still doing work as a customs officer, but he's still operating and living out of the customs building. But he doesn't seem to have very much work to do. And that seems to be kind of contributing to his malaise. But that's me just speculating a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So the husband, Abdullah, comes back again and has a confrontation, really, with Sukhov and other people. The customs officer does get involved in this, and so they try to escape, and this is the bit which reminded me most of a Western, or at least my kind of image of a Western. There was a kind of a shootout, quite a long extended shootout. There are these giant oil tanks, these giant oil containers, because of course they're on the banks of the Caspian, where oil is a big thing, a big industry, of course. And they escape with the wives from this museum through a secret tunnel. But they hide in these oil tanks, and the whole battle goes on around that. The customs official, because he misses his son, what was his name, Petrucha, becomes a kind of surrogate son for him to some extent. But then Abdullah comes along. He's initially imprisoned. Sorry, I missed this bit out. He's initially imprisoned, and then he sort of tricks Gülçatay into giving him some water. And then, quite unceremoniously, Gülçatay gets murdered. And then Petrucha gets murdered as well, straight afterwards. Abdullah having disguised himself initially as Gülçatay in the burqa. Then they have this huge shootout. And towards the beginning of the film, they booby-trapped one of these launches, one of these boats, with some dynamite that they found. And the idea being that if Abdullah tried to escape on it, it would explode. But unfortunately, the customs official, not knowing this, tries to help, and drives it along and explodes himself, leaving his wife abject after this. So all of this happens. Abdullah ends up getting killed, doesn't he?
His just desserts, yeah. Yep.
Yes, absolutely. And most of his gang as well, if not all of the gang. And at the end, Sukhov leaves them behind. And of course, it's not going to be quite the same again. Gulchatai is no longer there, but all the other wives are there. He leaves them behind and goes trudging off, presumably back to his wife, although there's an implication that he's actually maybe never going to get back to his wife, because he's just going to get involved in more stuff like this, which is all in a day's work for him, because he's a faithful, reliable Krasnoarmeets.
Yes, Red Army guy.
Yeah, whose duty it is to sort out things all over the world, or all over the empire at least, the former empire, the new Soviet Union. So I think we've covered the plot there. Anything I've missed out, do you think?
The only thing I would add is that Saeed, the local who Sukhov rescues at the beginning, shows up at a couple of important points and lends his skills with a rifle to Sukhov's cause. And there's a good chance that Sukhov would not have survived without these timely interventions, because they are very, very outnumbered. And that's, yeah, picking up on what you said about the Western type thing. I haven't seen a ton of Westerns either, but certainly I know that having a kind of standoff or a siege type scenario is not uncommon, or is something that features in quite a few Westerns. And definitely that bit towards the end did feel very Western-y to me. And I really like that you brought up the point at the end where it seems actually he's probably not heading back, despite his, you know, fairly regular intervals, you know, between major action scenes where he is continuing these letters to his wife. We pick up in the final one that it seems like he's always going to find an excuse not to go back, despite his professions of how much he wants to be at home.
Yes, I mean, we keep on cutting away, don't we, to his daydreams and the letters being read over the top of those. But yes, you're right. He does. This is his job. This is what is his job, and sorting out problems. I think sorting things out. There's a very, I'm going to have to paraphrase it. I think there's a lot of really quotable lines in here.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, because that's something we mentioned in the intro, is that it has kind of passed into the sort of popular Russian lexicon, if you like. But yes,
this line at the very end where he says something like goodbye ladies. They translated it in the subtitles I was watching as goodbye ladies, sorry for the inconvenience. And of course the inconvenience was all of the battle that went before, because he's such an easygoing guy and he never gets ruffled by anything. I think I would have probably translated what I heard as something more like sorry, it didn't go quite as planned. Sorry, it wasn't quite what we hoped, or something like that. But yeah, sorry for the inconvenience probably is a better translation in the end. But very droll line, I suppose, and bittersweet perhaps as well. But
yeah, I found it was quite poignant, because a couple of times, just when he's moving about the place, he kind of takes a register of the former harem and just reads out all of their names to check that they've all made it. And there's a repeated joke where Gulchatai, who we've mentioned already, isn't there because she's just kind of off, you know, kind of in a daydream or doing something else. And it's like, oh yeah, she's over there. Right, fine.
Yes.
But by the end, she doesn't answer the register, not because she's, you know, in Cloud Cuckoo Land again, but because she's been killed in the action. And it's sort of oh right, yes, things haven't turned out the way we wanted to.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole tone of the film was interesting. I mean, I have to say I had mixed feelings about it just a little bit, but certainly the first half of it, I would say, I was thinking, well, this is actually a lot more the kind of film I like than I almost expected it to be. Just the ironic tone to it. Counterpoint of what's happening with the heroes, totally, you know, not blasé, but stoic view of it is very very well done, very well written, I think, very very funny. I found as the people were actually getting killed, I started to think perhaps it wasn't quite so. I was feeling uneasy about how the tone fitted. You know, when Gul-Jadai just gets beaten to death, basically, and when Petrucha gets stabbed, I'm kind of glad for my sake it all happens off camera almost. I mean, the most horrible stuff you don't see, but I found that the tone are just a bit uncertain. I wasn't sure whether I was supposed to be enjoying it anymore or whether it had suddenly taken a left turn into something more serious or not. I wasn't quite sure about it. I don't know what you thought.
I was quite surprised by that as well. I see what you mean about taking a sudden left turn. I was just like, yeah, I mean, I guess I should have anticipated that not everyone would make it through just because of sort of the action genre. But yeah, you're right, it had been largely a comical tone up until that point, although we are told very early on that Abdullah has committed a massacre in this kind of outpost, you know, as he was on his way out of it when he's been chased out by the Red Army. But yeah, those two deaths coming one after another, and then Vereshchagin, the customs officer, inadvertently blowing himself up at the end, was kind of like, oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't feel like desperately sad about it, but it was, yeah, those took me by surprise, particularly the deaths of the two sort of young and sort of innocent characters, if you like.
Yeah. And when the ship blows up, I mean, one could imagine a situation where that is played for laughs, but it wasn't played for laughs, not at all, even though it is a quite, you know, almost absurd thing to happen. It wasn't. It was a supposed to be a moment where, and you see the wife crying and so on. You know, she'd been telling him not to get involved because he had been in the army, hadn't he? I assume. I really don't know. There are photos on the wall, aren't there? I don't know which war we're talking about here, but there are photos. Are we talking about First World War? Would be too soon before, wouldn't it? I wonder.
It would, yeah, because he's very firmly middle aged. So yeah, I don't know whether it would have been Russo-Japanese War or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably going to come up again as well, because one of the characters we haven't mentioned, who's really quite a minor one, but in amongst Abdullah's bandit cohort, he actually has a Russian character helping him out as well.
Yes, and he's dressed in army garb. I don't know enough about uniforms to say whether it's obvious that he's a member of the White Guard or not. He's wearing a different uniform from the Red Army guy, who's wearing a sort of white uniform, yeah, isn't he? Whereas this White Guard guy is not wearing white; he's wearing sort of green, dark green.
Yes, and I may be imagining this and misremembering it, but I feel like he had white gloves on, which, you know, together with the way he carries himself, gives him this sort of quite dandyish kind of air about him, which again one tends to associate with the White Army.
But he's also carrying a katana, right? Which is a Japanese sword, which I had to look up what one of those was. But it's a Japanese sword, right? And or a dagger or something like that. And just before we came back on air, we were discussing what this might be, and looking it up, it turns out that they'd clearly thought carefully about how they were characterising this guy. It was somebody who'd been in the White Guard, perhaps in Japan, and had come back this way and got involved in these bandits. And of course, the White Guard. And again, I'm not a huge expert on this period of history, but these were the rather a mixed bunch, as I understand, of anti-revolutionaries, so people who didn't want the revolution to happen, didn't like the communists, for varying reasons, and they were involved in Abdullah's gang.
Yeah, but the Japanese were one of the outside powers, it turns out, who were lending assistance to the whites because they really would prefer it if the communists didn't win the Russian Civil War. So,
well, yes, that's
sort of how he'd come by this particular weapon. But yeah, he was a character who made it slightly more comfortable in terms of the like ethnic/racial element, in that the villains aren't all, you know, Central Asians. There's a Russian mixed in as well.
True.
And of course, the fact that you've got Saeed fighting on Sukhov's side as well means that it's not just, you know, us nice Russians versus, you know, the nasty, untrustworthy Central Asian folk. So that made that aspect slightly less uncomfortable.
Yes. Any other moments worth bringing up? Oh, yes. Of course, he starts talking to the harem and telling them that, well, bigamy is no longer going to happen. Each of you is going to have their own husband. And they discuss, well, how can a man just have one wife? When we've got lots of wives, one of us looks after the baby, one of us does the cleaning, one of us does cooking, one mends the clothes. How do you manage with just one? Does she do it all? And he says, well, yeah, she does it all. And then he starts daydreaming again, and there's his wife, but there are 8 other wives doing all of the jobs, and he imagines it. My impression was that he imagined it, but he didn't really start thinking, yes, I want that.
Yeah.
My impression was, the way it was framed, was that he still loves his wife. He's not particularly tempted by these women, or even the idea of all of these of having 8 wives or something like that. I think he. It's framed in a way that he still loves his wife. What do you think?
Yeah, that scene is definitely is kind of played for laughs, but I think it plays like, oh, maybe that would be nice, but nah, I guess. But yeah, it's not, you know, I can imagine if this were a Carry On film or something like that. Not that I've seen a ton of Carry On films, but it would be kind of like, well, hey, how great is this? But it doesn't really come off that way. But
yeah, I mean, the first time he walks in on them, they have their burkas off, and of course he walks in and they're so embarrassed by having a strange man see their faces that they raise their skirts above their heads, and he sees their naked navels.
Yeah, sort of acres of midriff there, yeah. Which my wife was didn't particularly want to watch the film, but was sitting next to me on the sofa and was just kind of occasionally glancing over, and she just said, that's the dumbest thing ever.
Well, it was pretty stupid, yes, but there's no... Sukhov never... He's always doing his duty. He never starts to hit on, for want of a better word, these women. He's unlike Petrucha, who falls in love with Gulchatai, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah.
So, but again, that's very innocent. He's very young. So this is one of the phrases that comes up, is actually quite famous. My partner Karina mentioned that this was the phrase she brought up straight away when I mentioned I was going to be watching this film, which was Gulchatai Открой личико. That's right. Gulchatai Открой личико, which is Gulchatai, show me your beautiful face. Show me your sweet face.
Yeah, it's sort of a little Russian diminutive for face there, yes. Yeah, so.
Yes, and it comes up several times. Firstly, when he's trying to chat her up or whatever at the beginning, and he says he wants to marry her. And then later, of course... Later, Abdullah has disguised himself as under the burqa, and it's and Petrucha comes up with this phrase again, and of course it turns out that the face underneath is not Gulchatai's after all, but Abdullah's. Couple of other, there's one scene, another scene I found very funny. There, this white guard fellow is trying to steal grenades from the customs guy, from his house, I suppose, his cabin, and he goes in and I think he even tries to say, you know, I'm an officer, you need to do what I say, but of course, well, it's not certain who's in charge anymore, but so he ignores it. And then they cut outside, the door explodes in a shower of splinters, and this guy is propelled out of the room and down the stairs, and he comes out with this very funny phrase, which was да гранаты у него не той системы, which is yeah, his grenades aren't the right caliber.
Yes.
So having been kicked out, he gives this stupid excuse of why he hasn't got the grenades.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, they're not the right sort. Sorry, you know, but that's very, very funny when that happens. I think this seems to be one of the phrases that some people pick up on, because it's just a really stupid excuse. And everyone knows it's not true, but somebody's trying to save face.
Yes.
And give this kind of thing.
Yeah. And as we've seen with that character, he's a very vain man, so he's just the sort of person who would be coming up with a really dumb excuse to get himself off the hook.
And there is one other phrase, which this was the only one I'd heard before. And my first Russian teacher, this was back in Britain, she was Russian, of course, came out with this once. She didn't say where it was from at the time. Вопросы есть? Вопросов нет. And it's one person says it. Are there any questions? No, of course there aren't.
Yeah. In quick succession, without giving the person a second to say, actually, I do have a question. Yeah, yeah. Apparently,
yeah,
that's quite
exactly.
Common for people to say, like at the end of meetings, if they really want to go. And don't want to be detained any further, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And a couple of others now. Of course, thanks to Wikipedia, there's a whole list of phrases that apparently have become famous. But «таможня дает добро», so customs gives the green light. So this is when the customs official, I can't even remember what he agrees to now, but he agrees to do something. Oh, no, has he not just been beaten up?
Yeah, basically he's on this little boat, and it's been stormed by some of Abdullah's men, and they temporarily get the upper hand, and they say, yeah, customs gives the okay, or yes, as you say, gives the green light, because he's kind of temporarily surrendered.
Yeah. And apparently this is used whenever anybody ever gives sort of reluctant approval.
Yes.
And you say that, well, they've said it's fine, but of course they've only said it's fine because they had to, and not because they wanted to.
Yeah.
Oh, there's this one. They claim this is... I haven't heard... Karina said she'd heard about this one, but I hadn't heard this. Восток дело тонкое.
Oh, yes.
The Orient is a delicate matter.
Yeah, a subtle thing, yeah.
And people use it, apparently, not to talk about Asia or anything like that. They just say, you know, this is a delicate matter, and they say it like this. I assume it... Vostok would, you know, the Orient would give an idea of just otherness, any other... Something that works a different way and you don't understand. But again, it's not something I've heard... myself outside of this, but it certainly, you know, stands out a little bit in the film when they mention it towards the beginning.
Yeah, there were quite a few, pretty much all of those phrases actually that you've mentioned, I was sort of vaguely aware of, and I thought, do you know what? I think there was a Michelle Birdie who writes for the Moscow Times and writes a language column.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And lo and behold, I have a book of collected columns, and there's a whole article. About this movie.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and so I was like, oh yes, it was from that, and yes, Vostok Diela Tonka is definitely, yeah, one of those.
Yeah, that's in the Moscow Times. Yeah, she writes this column every week or every 2 weeks. Yeah, that's right. Yes, I haven't seen that exact one, but I have seen her columns for sure.
Yeah, if I remember, I'll try and find it and post a link to it.
There was a song in it. Now, I have to admit, the song's melody has not stuck in my mind, but it is the refrain, the words from the refrain, «Не везет мне в смерти, повезет в любви». I'm unlucky in death, but maybe I'll be lucky in love. This comes up throughout, and apparently this is a very influential... Well, influential? I don't know. Famous, certainly. Famous song. But I hadn't heard it before. I don't know if you'd heard it before.
No, I hadn't. But in my little bit of preparatory reading that I did, I discovered that the lyrics of the songs, although not the vocals themselves, as I understand it, were written by Bulat Okudzhava, who's one of these figures that they... It's referred to as a bard, and that's literally the Russian word is bard or bardi. And they were, I guess, the nearest equivalent we have is like folk singers.
I'll tell you what bardovskie piesny remind me of. They remind me of French chanson, like Jacques Brel. I don't know exactly chronologically where Russian bardovskie piesny fit, but yeah. It's funny because there's a Russian style of singing called chanson, which is different again.
Yeah.
But French chanson and this bardi, I do find quite similar, really. They remind me of Jacques Brel a lot.
Hmm. Yeah, so it's kind of like it's usually one guy with an acoustic guitar, and usually quite melancholic lyrics, as you've yeah described. This definitely fits the bill of that. And I think he was famous in the, I want to say, 50s and 60s is when he sort of, I guess, he can't have been fully underground because he, you know, otherwise he wouldn't have been contributing to this movie. But I think they were sort of, they weren't like official culture, but they weren't like suppressed either, and they were very popular. But it's, I'm really out of my depth on the subject of Bardi, but I am sort of aware of them being like a very, you know, Russian / Soviet cultural phenomenon, I guess.
Because this film, when I mentioned it to a few people at work, they said they described it as a cult film. It wasn't exactly a mainstream film when it came out. It was made by an experimental film unit, partly by Len Film. I think they were using some of the facilities of Len Film, but it was mostly, you know, an experimental unit. It wasn't very mainstream. Mm. It wasn't even immediately released, as I understand it. It was only when Brezhnev saw it that he said, oh, this is great, because Brezhnev liked real westerns, and he said it was so great that it got a wider release. And it was made as a kind of very small, really quite small scale, well, small release film, or even no release film.
Yeah, which is interesting, because I thought the production values, as far as I could tell, were quite impressive. I mean, I love the look of the thing. Like, you know, you get this the contrast with these brilliant blue skies and, you know, and the desert, and then these very austere looking Central Asian buildings. It looked really cool. That was probably one of my favorite things about the film, actually.
Well, they kind of went to real locations, perhaps is not a fair way to describe it, but they went to places which already had the look, I think. I think a couple of the buildings were sort of sets, or, you know, mock-ups made for the film. I think the custom official's house was built for the film, was just a sort of a mock-up. But when you see that huge building, I don't know what it was built as, like a fortress or a temple. I don't really know. I mean, a mosque or something at Merv. Well, that's because it was there and they just were able to film it. So, yeah, it was maybe that's how they managed to do it, just using what they could find, real places. Not a Tuppenny Ha'penny production for certain.
Sure, yeah. And you know, all Soviet films, because that's how everything worked, it would have been state-funded. It just wouldn't have necessarily been one that the state, you know, showered with resources. It must have been, you know, like a second tier, okay, here's some money, go off and make a film, rather than like, this is going to be the big hit for the masses type thing.
Yeah. And it's a short film, isn't it? It's only 80 minutes long, which...
Yeah, I was quite surprised. I assumed, just because I tend to think, you know, it's characterized as being like an equivalent to a Western. Often those are, you know, 2 hours plus, you know, if you're talking Good, Bad and the Ugly, it's the better part of 3 hours, if not more. So I was pleasantly surprised by the short running time, I have to say.
Yeah, definitely didn't outstay its welcome. You know, no chance to get bored. There's quite a lot of action, of course, and just drollery along the way. It was really, yes, really quite easy to watch. Available for free on YouTube, of course, so if any of our listeners are interested in watching it, then it won't be difficult and won't take very much time to do so.
Yes, and when there's no cost involved, it's kind of like, that helps. It's not like, I recommended you a movie that you have to buy like on DVD for 15 quid, and then it's rubbish, and you go, "Ugh, what a waste of money."
with subtitles, of course, you can watch it with English subtitles.
Sure, and that's great.
Or indeed all sorts of language subtitles. Yeah. If you're so inclined.
Yeah. But to bring it back round to your friends and colleagues' view of the film, you say they mentioned that it was a cult film. How did they feel about the film when you mentioned that you were going to watch it? Is it a favourite of theirs or?
Karina mentioned that she'd seen it. Although she couldn't tell me very much about it. I don't think it was one of her favourites. But I talked to my boss, Olga, at work, And she mentioned that she very much enjoyed it when she was a child. It wouldn't have been a new film then, but it was on TV, I suppose. And she thought it was very funny. She could quote bits to me, and it was just part of the furniture, or whatever you like to say, part of the background, that everyone knew it and everyone liked it.
Yeah, from what I've heard, it seems like it has a place in Russian culture not dissimilar to something like The Great Escape or The Italian Job, in that it's not necessarily something that everyone of our generation has seen all the way through, but you've probably caught like 5 or 10 minutes on TV at some point and minimum have heard the famous lines. So I don't know whether that's a fair analogy, and hopefully you know, some of our Russian listeners will correct me if I'm wrong, but that's sort of the impression that I've got from what I've heard about it.
Yeah, it seems to be. I did mention it. I think I mentioned it to some of my teen students, and they weren't familiar with it. Mm. I don't think. Oh no, one of them said they had heard of it, but they hadn't watched it, and that I think their mum and dad had watched it. Yeah, I mean, obviously it's from a different time.
Yeah, it's nearly a 50-year-old movie at this point.
Yeah, 69, is that right? Is that when it was made?
Yes, 69, I think, released in 70, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know how much traction it would have with, or traction, if that's the word, how much knowledge younger people would have of it right now. I noticed that, again, thanks to Wikipedia, the customs official guy has become a kind of a symbol of customs officials in general, and apparently there's across Russia and Ukraine there are places where his statue stands. Customs officials, you know, celebrate him, shall we say, although I didn't think it was a particularly positive portrayal of a customs official somehow, but there we are.
Yeah, certainly mixed, because he's, you know, there's no doubting his bravery, but yes, he is a bit of a washed-up alcoholic at this yes. point, but for reasons that we understand as we've been into.
Before watching the film, we mentioned, I mentioned in passing, Carry On Up the Khyber, and I only mentioned it rather jokingly, but it was strange that there were elements of this film that really actually did remind me of it. That was from 1968, so a very similar time.
Mm.
And I was thinking about how we might, with a modern Western eye, look at the kind of portrayal of different races in the film. One big thing is that, of course, there are Turkmen people in this film who are mostly played by people who are not from Turkmenistan. So Abdullah is a Georgian guy. The wives are mostly Russian, as far as I could tell. And in fact, when they're wearing their masks, they're played by all sorts of different people, as I understand. There's four or five people, right. three or four people, some of them men, playing some of the wives. And I was sort of thinking, well, it's no reason to look down necessarily on Soviet cinema for this, because of course, Carrying Up the Khyber, for the same time, you've got Kenneth Williams wearing boot polish, dressed as a Kashmiri prince? I can't remember now. Certainly, supposedly South Asian person, but of course played by a white guy in a turban, and the Bernard Breslau dressed as a Gurkha and that kind of thing. The Saeed is played, as I understand it, by a Russian in this. Obviously, sympathetic characters.
Oh, okay. I hadn't realised that.
As far as I know. And I wouldn't say in themselves they are particularly racist portrayals. I mean, Abdullah's the bad guy, but he's not grotesque, shall we say, some kind of racist grotesque. But of course, you're still left with the Russians definitely the good guys, the Soviets sorting out the wild Asian characters in the film, and you've got the sympathetic characters like the wives and Saeed himself, but they definitely need the kind of paternalistic hand of the Russians to sort them out and to modernise them, shall we say. And in that, it reminded me very much of the book by Kipling called Kim, probably, to be honest, one of my favourite books. Very exciting story, I found. Very vividly painted view of what British India would be like. But of course, again, even though in Kim you've got white people who are portrayed as racist, that's to say they're not good by dropping, you know, racial epithets and that kind of thing, and generally looked down on by the author, still very much pro-empire. You've got the good British guys keeping everybody in check, running things, and everybody's happy to be run by the British people there. And I was reminded of both of these things when I was watching the film. The portrayal of the harem was quite, I would say, caricatured. You know, all of these little ladies sort of tottering around, and that was played for comedy, I would say, and that reminded me very much of the Kipling film. of the Carry On film, I should say. Sorry.
Yeah, caricature is totally fair, and they're the only female characters in the movie, with the exception of Sukhov's wife, who we only see in his imagination.
Yes, and who never speaks, of course.
And never speaks. And also...
Custom official's wife.
Yes, Vereshchagin's wife.
What's her name? Nastasia, I think her name is, isn't it? Nastasia.
Yes. So we do... We have named female characters, but they don't really have very much... you know, developed personalities. I mean, Gulchitai is the only one of the wives, really, although there is... You do briefly hear from the former favourite wife, but they kind of don't really go anywhere with that story. And then, as I say, Vereshchagin, the custom official's wife, we hear a little bit from her, but she's mainly there to kind of scream, no! And sort of, don't do that, it's dangerous, you'll die, and then, you know...
Well, that's true. Yeah, she is quite a micro. To be honest, I found her... I think, as I mentioned before, I found her role in it, although it was small, I found it quite well drawn, in a way that perhaps the wives were not, the harem were not. But yes, so this kind of imperialist view, I mean, in this case, Russian, but I was thinking it very similar to the kind of English or British imperialist view that might have existed, well, goodness knows, up until the 50s at least.
arguably in certain pockets up to the present day, but
well, yes.
So let's probably not get too deep down into that. And yeah, you could say with Said, there's kind of elements of the, you know, the so-called noble savage trait with him. He's very laconic, and the kind of sort of debt of honor for saving Sukhov is an important motivator for him, and also he has the sort of the avenging his honour type thing. And you could definitely have those being motivations for a white character, but they just feel very, like, stereotypical to me anyway.
Yes. And I also mentioned Kafkaska Klinitz, actually, which, of course, that contains caricatures. But I didn't walk away from that thinking, well, that was all about how the Russians ought to be in charge. It was just about... somewhat caricatured view of what it's like in the Caucasus. There didn't seem to be a message behind that, you know, an imperialist message. Whereas I felt that with this film, there definitely was that kind of message. In the end, you need this Russian soldier to sort everything out.
Yeah,
and that's where he's going. That's what he's going to do next, probably in the next adventure that he's going off on at the end.
Yeah. I'm kind of shoehorning this in, but, and maybe this is a pretentious comparison, but I felt like there was a slight kind of like Odysseus-like quality to Sukhov, in that he's wily and he's clever, but also he's sort of permanently on his way back from this war, and he's, you know, it may be a long time before he gets home. And also, he's not particularly good to be around. I mean, he's very competent, but you notice that everyone who's alongside him is sort of dropping like flies.
Yes.
So, yes, excuse that bit of pretension, but that did occur to me when we were wrapping it up.
Yes, I think Odysseus is one of those classic hero stories, isn't it? But the final bit of a hero story is the reintegration, isn't it, into their normal lives again? And this guy never gets that. Although who knows what's next for him? But
yeah, I did read that Sukhov was actually a character who was in quite a few books. So it'd be interesting to kind of investigate that and see whether he ever does he ever does make it home. But yeah.
I was reading a tiny bit about the production, and it turned out that, that nobody wanted to direct it. Nobody thought they could direct it. And they were even talking about, well, you could, if it's a Western, you can only get Americans to be in a Western. No Russian could do it. And and this guy who played Sukhov, Anatoly Kuznetsov is his name, and he was not the first choice to play him. Somebody else was going to play him. And then he got into a brawl or something like this. It sounds like the story of this film is that everything you don't see off camera, they were getting drunk all the time and beating each other up.
Wow.
And the first guy who was playing Sukhov got taken off the film for that reason, apparently. And so all sorts of stuff going on. The guy playing Vereshchagin had his legs amputated, or his feet at least amputated, and you can't see it in the film, but apparently he's wearing prosthetic legs and that kind of thing. There's all sorts of little bits of nuggets of factoids of trivia here, but yeah, it sounds like a lot was going on behind the scenes that we would never know from watching the film.
Yeah, that definitely surprises me, because it doesn't come across, you know, as not a well put together film, you know.
Quite a somewhat complicated film with all the action scenes and things.
Sure.
I would have thought.
Yeah.
And the location work, you know, it's not simple to do, is it?
No. How did you enjoy the action elements of it?
I can't say they were my favourite parts. My favourite parts were the juxtaposition, if again pretentious words, okay, juxtaposition of the quiet, calm commentary that Sukhov's providing and the stuff that's happening around him. Just the tone of it, the ironic tone, I thought I really enjoyed. But the action scenes, I felt that when they started happening, I just kept thinking to myself, well, when's this going to be over and we can get on with the real matter at hand, which is the wry comments. I can imagine some people might find them more exciting.
I felt that they were kind of surprisingly lacking in intention, despite, you know, when you describe them, it sounds like, you know, it's a siege that would be quite tense. But I guess it's hard to pin down exact directorial choices, but maybe it just, I wasn't that involved with the characters. Perhaps that's part of it, because a lot of them were quite flimsy, and even Sukhov is very charismatic, but there's maybe, I figured he was going to make it through, so I wasn't too worried for him. So I guess that contributed. But I did notice, though, that there was some distinct kind of Clint Eastwood-ing, if you can use Clint Eastwood as a verb, going on. There were three characters who would definitely give the man with no name a run for his money, or maybe it should be a run for his fistful of dollars, because... Yeah.
Yeah, I'm afraid you'll have to explain to me what you're referring to, because I, to my shame, I don't think I've ever seen a Clint Eastwood film.
Oh, well, it's the trio of films, A Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, and then The Good, the Bad and the Ugly.
Right.
And he just does this sort of implausible, managing to shoot four or five guys dead with single shots each, despite the fact that he's, you know, clearly surrounded, and, you know, at least one of them should land a hit on them. And there's Vereshchagin, Sukhov, and Said all managed fairly similar feats at one point or another, and you kind of think, well, one of those guys being that good a shot, it's rather stretching plausibility, but all three is kind of ridiculous. But they were cool moments, I thought, even if kind of...
Yes, I can see what you mean, yes. And the siege, I mean, I like the idea of it. Sukhov's got this machine gun, hasn't he, that he acquired early on in the film. And he's on top of the oil tank, isn't he, shooting at people. And then there's that bit where he leaps down from the back of the oil tank, and they all think he's still there, but he's not. He's down at the back, and he's attacking people from there. That I remember that was somewhat exciting, but I have to say I didn't find the action scenes, they weren't the things that, even though perhaps they were the things that took all the effort to do in the film, I found that the thing that I was enjoying was the ironic tone. Although as I said, when people started dying for real, I found that I was uneasy. I didn't know whether I was enjoying it as much then, and I'm not sure if it was the effect they were aiming for with the film, or it was just me not... Well, the film kind of losing me a little bit when it started happening, some of the people dying.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt like it was intentionally melancholic, but maybe that's just me leaning too heavily on, you know, my stereotypes of, you know, how Russians like to tell their stories. It's not a real story unless most people die.
Right.
Unless it's, you know, a straight comedy, which this is definitely a comedy-inflected action, I guess you would call it.
Yeah. I'm curious as to whether many real Westerns have that kind of comedic, ironic tone. Like I said, I'm not somebody who's watched Westerns at all, really. But do they have this kind of ironic tone to them, or is this something that this film added, do you think?
Similarly, I haven't seen a ton, and it's a long time since I've seen the Clint Eastwood Man With No Name films, and there's not, at least if memory serves, there's not as many, like, obviously funny lines. It's more kind of like wry or, you know, deadpan phrases. I'm not saying they're films without humour, but I felt like the humour was like a more, you know, maybe not even front and centre, but like a considerable part of the mix. But there's certainly like a, I guess, like a deadpan, you know, atmosphere or, you know, style that carries across. Like, I think one of my favourite moments was Sukhov lighting, I think it was a cigarette, but it might have been a cigar, with a lit stick of dynamite that's just been thrown to him.
Oh, that's right, yes. And then he throws it away after that, doesn't he?
Yes, just in time. But it's a very kind of like, this is how cool as a cucumber I am. You know, I know just how long this is going to burn, so I can do this and then throw it away and not get hurt. It's stupid, but it's very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I feel like we've kind of covered this film, you know, probably in as much detail as we can without, you know, totally negating any point in actually watching a thing. But would you recommend this to, I guess, people who don't have a particular interest in Russia or Russian cultural stuff? Do you think there's enough kind of going on that you would recommend it?
I think people would enjoy it. It's short, as I said. It the pace is relatively quick and it's funny. And I don't think you'd have to know Russian to find it funny, to be honest. If you were the subtitles don't lose too much when it's there. I think just having a tiny bit of the historical background, which, as I say, I knew very little about it, but I just did a tiny bit of reading to find out what was going on, what the setting was supposed to be, would help.
Yeah, because that's definitely... The setting is much more implicit than explicit.
Yes, they don't. If this was a modern Hollywood film, there would be a prologue where they told you exactly what was going on, right? Like at the beginning of Les Miserables or something like that, where there's just a title card which tells you the historical context. But they just assumed everybody knew it, right? In this case, I think it's worth a watch. Really, I did enjoy it. I'm glad I watched it, notwithstanding some of the comments I've made, perhaps. But it's one of the most popular Russian films ever, certainly Soviet films. Russian films, because I couldn't think of a non-Soviet Russian film that was more popular. Really very popular, very sort of part of the culture, but something that I think you could enjoy. It's not a super high art film the way something by Tarkovsky might be, which obviously has a worldwide audience who are not necessarily especially interested in Russia, but it's not that kind of film. But to be honest, I find these films which possibly reflect popular tastes more, I find them even more interesting somehow. Soviet films in this case.
Yeah, sure, because although as we've discussed, it wasn't necessarily anticipated that it was going to be a big hit. You know, the people involved thought this is going to be hopefully be a crowd pleaser. Yeah, because they, you know, not a ton of super artistic films were made, at least as I understand it, or at least they were very hard to get made in the Soviet Union, because I could be totally wrong and I may need complete correction here, but my understanding was that stuff that was entertaining tended to be more favoured by the people doing the funding.
Yeah, I think Tarkovsky was finding money very difficult to get. But then this film also, because it had cult origins, I suppose, even though it became so popular, I think this was also difficult to get the money for. I think it was made not... I really ought not to say things like this without checking it. I think it was made not long after the epic War and Peace adaptation that won an Oscar. I think that's right.
Yes, obviously, yeah, that was mid to late 60s as well, yeah.
That was an ultra, an ultra high budget thing, the kind of, huge prestige project, obviously with a very famous source. I think you're right, there were quite a lot of, popular films made that were easier to fund, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So before we go then, Ed, is there anything that you would like to direct listeners towards?
Yes. Well, I do post on Twitter from time to time, at Edward Rusher. And very occasionally I make some little funny songs with funny videos, perhaps. There's nothing very Russian about most of them. And you can find that on the YouTube channel with a name that seemed like a good idea at the time, but as the years go by, seems less so. Giant Squid Rule. I can't even explain why it's that. There's no special reason. But that's the channel on YouTube, and you can see a few funny songs with funny videos. That's my little project that comes up every few months, perhaps.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being a fantastic guest, Ed. And yeah, we'll have to do this again sometime.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for the chance. And thank you very much for introducing me to this film.
Yeah. And thanks for watching it with me as well, because it's definitely one I've wanted to tick off the list for quite some time. And I'm really glad I did. All right. Do svidaniya, folks.
Do svidaniya.
Hello again. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Russo Files Unite podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, I'd love to hear from you. There's a couple of different ways you can do that. There's a Russo Files Unite Facebook group you can join. We're on Twitter at Russo Files U. That's Russo Files with the letter U at the end. We're on Instagram at Russo Files _Unite. And you can also email at russofilesunite@gmail.com. Also, if you can spare a couple of minutes to rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, that will help other people hear about the show and would be very much appreciated. Thanks again for listening, and goodbye.